Welcome back to the program. Sometimes it's reassuring, but oftentimes very sad that the strains of history repeat themselves. In the process, we often see how little we've learned along the way. From 1915 to 1970, the exodus of almost 6 million African Americans from the South to the North and West changed the face of America. Former New York Times reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson tells their story in her new book, The Warmth of Other Suns. In doing so, she interviewed more than 1,000 people and gained access to new data, official records, and has written the definitive dramatic account of how these Americans journeyed and how that journey has altered our cities, our country, and ourselves. In telling the story, one of her three central characters around which the story is built, the story of one of those characters parallels all too closely the story that we're witnessing with respect to Trayvon Martin. Isabel Wilkerson won the 1994 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing for her reporting as Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times. The award made her the first black woman in the history of American journalism to win the Pulitzer Prize. She's lectured on narrative writing at the Nieman Foundation at Harvard and is currently professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction at Boston University. It is my singular pleasure to welcome Isabel Wilkerson back to this program to talk about The Warmth of Other Suns. Isabel Wilkerson, thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, great to be here.
Great to have you back. Well, last time we talked a lot about the journey itself and some of the things that were faced by so many of the people that made the journey. One of the things I want to talk about a little bit is really what precipitated the journey. What was it that really provided the impetus to so many people to risk giving up everything that they had and really changing their circumstances in dramatic ways to make this journey?
Well, one of the overarching conditions that propelled so many people to leave, 6 million Americans were part of this internal migration, was that there is this overarching caste system in which from Virginia to Florida to Texas, there was a two-tiered system in which it was so divided that there was a determination as to what a person could do from the moment they got up until the moment they went to sleep. It was so divided and so arcane that it was actually against the law in Birmingham for a black person and the white person to merely play checkers together. And in courtrooms throughout the South, there was actually a black Bible and a separate white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. And this caste system endured from the time of it, much of the 20th century, from Plessy versus Ferguson until the 1970s, believe it or not. And this was so arcane and artificial a hierarchy that it required intense enforcement and, in fact, violence in order to maintain something as artificial as this. And for that, every 4 days, an African American was lynched for some perceived breach of the caste system that I've described. And this is the overarching condition that in some ways they were fleeing, defecting in some ways from one part of the country to another in order to be seen as the citizens that they had been born to be.
What sense did they have that in fact conditions might be better along the East Coast and in the North and West?
Well, one of the things that they had always been aware of was that there had been during the slavery times. We're not talking about slavery here, but you know, going back for generations, there was this determination to escape the states where people had been slaves, and so you had the Underground Railroad, which had ferried out a significant but really small by comparison number of people who had been enslaved. And so there had always been this dream of getting out of the altogether, in some ways, hostage-holding region in which they had been consigned by birth. But there had been no way to get out. There had been no means or opportunity for large numbers of them to leave until World War I. And that was because during World War I, it was the North that had a problem, and because of the need for labor at the precise time that Europe was at war. And that meant that European immigrants were no longer available to work the factories and the steel mills. And so the North actually came to recruit them. And that was the first time that large numbers of African Americans had a chance to escape the caste system into which they had been born.
Of course, the other side of that equation was the degree to which the South wanted to do everything possible to keep them there, because the hollowing out of the South was going to create economic hardship.
That's one of the great ironies of this migration. On the one hand, the people were being treated as second or third class citizens openly and without apology. They were being beaten and many of them killed for any breach of the caste system that had been created to hold them there. And yet when they tried to leave, there were great efforts to keep them from doing so. They would actually arrest people from the railroad platforms. They would actually arrest people in their train seats. And when there were too many people to arrest, they would wave the train on through so that people who had been saving and hoping and dreaming of the chance to get to freedom had to watch the train leave without them. So there's a tremendous amount of effort to keep them from going.
Also, there is this aspect of it that is really similar to any kind of migration, where you have a self-selecting population that really makes the journey and really gives special credence to those people that do immigrate.
This is really such a universal human story, as you are saying. This is what, in some ways, populated much of the United States to begin with. I mean, people came across the Atlantic, they came across the Pacific Ocean, they crossed the Rio Grande in order to find a freer, fuller lives for themselves and for their children and their unseen grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And so this is a truly human story of what anyone would do if they are faced with untenable circumstances. One of the things that the book asks in this entire migration, or any migration asks, is what would you have done had you been in the circumstances of the people such as this? And in some ways, all of us owe our very existence to the fact that someone had to have done what the people in this great migration did just for us to be here, because all of us are, to one degree or the other, products of people who came from different migration streams to make it to this country.
One of the other things you talk about is that the migration wasn't random, that people from different places very specifically went to certain other places.
The migration, this particular migration, well, every migration actually is actually beautifully predictable and very well thought out. I think it does a disservice to any migration to think that people just wander into a place. It takes a lot of effort and forethought to cross the Atlantic or to get from Texas to Oakland. I mean, it takes a lot of effort to even make that journey. And so this migration actually unfolded in three different streams. There's one up the East Coast, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, up the East Coast in New York and Washington, Philadelphia. There was a middle stream, which carried people from Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Arkansas to Chicago and Cleveland and the entire Midwest. And then there was the great stream that carried people from Texas and Louisiana to California and the entire West Coast, going as far as Alaska. I've actually been to Alaska talking about this book, and that was the farthest possible migration that you could make in this country, and there are people who did that too.
And in fact, you've looked at these streams in the context of really three key characters in The Warmth of Other Suns.
That's right. There was the first to leave was a woman who was in Mississippi. She had been a sharecropper's wife who had the misfortune of having been terrible at picking cotton. If, you know, you don't think about people being good or bad at it, but she happened to have been bad at it. But it turned out that her family left because there had been a beating. One of her in-laws had been beaten to within an inch of his life, and her husband at that point said to her, "This is the last crop we're making," and they set forth on a journey to get to the Midwest, to ultimately to Chicago, and they couldn't tell anyone because during that era, you couldn't just tell anyone because people, there could be efforts to keep you from going, and therefore they had to keep it to themselves. The second person to leave left the state of Florida, and ironically left from the same region that is now gripping the nation because of the killing of a young man named Trayvon Martin. He left that same region. He was from the citrus picking area, which is what that region was known for at the time in the 1940s. He had been a college student, but his name was George Starling. He'd been a college student, but the money ran out, and so he had to return to picking citrus, as had most of the people around there. But because he'd been to college, he was aware of how the people were being mistreated. He was aware that the work was dangerous, and they were being paid very little for their hard labor and the dangers that were attending that labor. And so he set about trying to negotiate for better work conditions and a little higher pay, meaning pennies on the box for fruit that was going to go on the open market for many, many dollars a box. And for doing that, he actually came squarely in the face of the very caste system that was holding the people down for so long. It was unacceptable for an African-American male to take on the system in that way, to take on the Grove owners. They were not accepting of that. And for his having done that, they actually planned a lynching for him, and he had to flee for his life. And the standoff that forced him to leave occurred in the exact same town that Trayvon Martin, where he was killed, in Sanford, Florida.
Certainly, the more things change, the more they remain the same in some of these towns.
In many cases, it's a sad, tragic, you know, reminder of the fact that these attitudes and conditions that led to the caste system being created to begin with may still have echoes to this day. And I think that if George Starling were around, I think he would have a very heavy heart to see what's going on in the place that he had to flee many years ago.
Of course, it also parallels the Emmett Till story as well.
It does, because in some ways you have a young man who is, you know, apparently going about his business, you know, coming from a convenience store, and there is some encounter with a person who we do know, based upon the 911 tapes, was following him. What exactly ensued after that, we truly don't know, but we do know that this individual was unarmed and is now dead from a gunshot wound that was inflicted by this individual. And in so many ways, it seems as if you have a young man in a place with a very long, fraught history, who is apparently not even aware of the dangers that he may be facing, and of people who, you know, not even perhaps even aware of all that may have preceded their own attitudes, are acting. We don't know what was on Zimmerman's heart or on his mind, but we do know that there's a history that precedes all of us. And clearly, this was happening in a place that has a very deep history when it comes to these issues.
Part of that history revolves around this idea of vigilante justice, which seems to be so deeply inculcated in the culture of places like Sanford, Florida.
It is, in fact, the standoff in the Groves that forced George Starling to flee in 1945 had a vigilante taint to it, or edge to it, because at that moment the Grove owner, it was viewed that many of the people there had guns to begin with. During that standoff, there could have been a shooting then, but they decided to do things as was more common in that day, which was to plan a lynching, which would have had a greater impact, they would have viewed, on the group as a whole. In fact, the reason that he ended up having to leave was because many of the people around him were so frightened about what could happen that they actually went to the Grove owners and said that they themselves were nervous about and were willing to accept what was, you know, whatever pennies were coming to them, because of the atmosphere of fear that occurs in a vigilante society.
And what's frightening is the degree to which some of that fear is still as prevalent as it is, something that those of us in the West or the North or the Northeast don't really understand or have trouble coming to grips with sometimes.
It is, and I think that's one reason why there's such an outpouring of outrage over what's happened here. The shooting itself is something that is incomprehensible to many people, but secondarily, the reaction to it, the fact that that there has been no arrest, which is also all too familiar when you look at the long arm of history and you put these strands together and you see that in so many of these cases, there's so many cases in Florida alone where there had been killings. There was a bombing in 1951 of one of the very early civil rights killings occurred in Florida, a place called Mims, involving a man who had been a civil rights worker before even civil rights had a name. He was working for the NAACP. The lone person, his name was Harry T. Moore. Very few people know his name. And he was going around Florida trying to raise awareness about the need for voter registration in a state where blacks still could not vote at that time. They're talking about the 1940s and 50s. And also to get teachers' wages for African-colored, for black teachers. And so for doing that, there actually was a bomb placed under his bed. On Christmas Day, 1951, he was killed in this bomb blast of that was part of this vigilante atmosphere that he was working under. And so, and yet, to this day, there's not been a person who's ever spent a day in jail for that killing. And there have been so many slayings such as that, that even take you into the 1980s and 90s in Miami of black people who had been shot and killed by police officers, setting off riots in Miami in 1980 and 1982 and in 1989, and all of the people, the slayers, the people who actually did the killing, and even acknowledged having done so, all of them were acquitted. So you look at the continuum, and you look at the strands of history that still seem to be following a pattern, and that's what leads to so much of the outrage here, is that yet again there's been a killing and no one is in police custody. Much of the evidence is now probably very likely deteriorated or lost perhaps for all time, because most of this evidence needed to have been collected in the first 24 hours, and clearly that's long past.
And the fact that there's been no arrest even, or no one brought into police custody for questioning even, did Zimmerman or anybody else?
The testing for chemicals in one's blood was done on the victim, but not on the person who acknowledged having done the shooting. The clothing, we do not know what's happened with the clothing. So this is not even about so much race. This is about justice as it is mm-hmm. carried out, as it should be carried out in any such case. Any killing of any individual would involve a certain amount of vigilant and careful and cautious investigation, and it does not appear that that's happened here. And that all affirms the right, one would seem, to have a vigilante society when there are no consequences for one's actions. Which is why people are so outraged.
Talk about that outrage and the public reaction to something that seems clearly anachronistic, as we're talking about. It's something that seems almost fictional in its scope to a lot of people.
You know, I think that one of the sad realities of all of this is that there's been this fixation and sense of longing to understand and to know more information on the part of so many Americans and people actually around the world, trying to piece together what is it that happened, because something seems so very wrong. Mm-hmm. And yet the people who should actually be doing this would think the authorities and a grand jury. I mean, and that is what is so mind-numbing about this entire situation, is that it's left to ordinary Americans, ordinary citizens, and people who really care about social justice and the right thing being done in whatever might be the case of whatever happened here. We will never truly know, as long as it's left up to individuals to try to figure out something that only the authorities really have access to. And so that leaves all of us feeling helpless and trying to sort things out ourselves.
Is it your sense that the outrage will continue? I mean, we have a society today where the attention span seems to be a whole lot shorter, and where we're pretty quick to flit on to the next thing.
I think that it's hard to know, because something else happens and it catapults people's attention towards something else. I think, however, that one of the few hopeful things about this entire situation is that there have been mass protests all over the country that almost are redolent of the civil rights era and the March on Washington. You might say that there have been little marches on Washington all over the country over this one case. This one case seems to have galvanized people in ways that no other recent situation similar to this has done. And that's reason for hope, too, because it means that people are having their photographs taken in hoodies. You know, the former governor of Michigan is photographed in a hoodie. All of this to suggest that something is clearly wrong, not just with Florida, not just with the South, but with the society in general. If a young person, if a teenager, can be shot and killed on a sidewalk by an individual who is not a police officer, bad enough if it were a police officer, but could be shot and killed, and there seem to be no consequences for that, and that the criminal justice system that's supposed to protect all of us does not appear to be working as one would expect it to. And so I think that his photograph going out there to the world on and on, as the information begins to filter out, more information even coming from Zimmerman, I mean, people just want to know what happened. I think that that's what has fueled this outrage and this concern. Until there's an arrest, I think that there will be this sense of incompletion, which has everyone in its grip and keeps the outrage at a very high level.
There was also this feeling in large parts of the country that somehow we had moved beyond this sense of suddenly living in a post-racial society, and the election of Barack Obama being kind of the apotheosis of that. And this seems to be such a setback in so many ways.
In so many ways, you're so right. It feels as if this is almost a relapse from an illness we thought we'd recovered from. And I think it kind of was a shock to everyone to see that something so starkly, almost simple in its appearance on the face of it. Obviously, it's far more complicated than that, than what we can possibly know. But something so humanly ordinary as walking home, a teenager walking home from a convenience store, unarmed, with this candy and an iced tea, trying to catch the rest of a game. How ordinary and human is that? And a person could lose one's life because of someone else misinterpreting that individual as potentially a criminal, and how you know, a singular moment can change, you know, a young life in that way. And I think that that's one of the things that has shocked people into thinking, we thought we were past that. This is 2012. And what's interesting about that is that at every point in history, every time something like this happens, someone will say, but we thought we were past this. Here we are in 1998, or here we are in 2003, or here we are in 2008, or here we are in 2012. And we keep saying that, which suggests to me that we've never really truly dealt with the underlying causes and the real underlying problem behind the illness that we're now having a relapse from. Maybe we have dealt with the symptoms, but have never really dealt with the underlying problem beneath all of this.
Is there any reason to think now that we're willing to have that conversation to deal with the underlying problems,
I think that as long as we continue to speak of it in the past tense, we will never really deal with it. To say that you once had an illness but it's no longer in your system anymore means that you are not going to deal with it because there's no problem to deal with. Clearly, there's been this outpouring of support, but there also have been on online comments and discussions, there have been people there have been divisions even on this, and there have been people who have looked to, in some ways, as in a rape case, find things that they can pin on this teenager who is no longer here to defend himself. The whole idea that there is residue of marijuana on his book bag. Mm-hmm. Is suddenly reason to believe that perhaps he might have deserved what happened to him. I mean, there's almost this linking of those two, and that seems to be, you know, I don't think that there's anywhere in this country where, even if that's true, that one deserves the death penalty for that. So I think that that potentially one would hope that this would be a case that would allow the country at this time to begin really examining, how did we get to this point? How did we get to this point, and how can we learn from it?
And, of course, the other side of that, though, is the degree to which, and you touched on it a moment ago, the degree to which we're already seeing this become politicized to a certain extent, and there's reason to think that could become worse.
I have reason to believe that actually the more it's talked about, the more, in some ways, which may not be a bad thing on some level, the deep-seated attitudes that might compel one to look at this from the different prisms that almost precede us without our even knowing. These are all in many respects subconscious reactions to something that comes before us, and we're trying to make sense of it. If one actually believes that we're in a post-racial society, then this could not possibly have anything to do with race. It's just not possible. If one looks at the history of the country and recognizes that in some ways there was never a truth commission for all of the atrocities that occurred in the South and in other parts of the country involving this long history of a caste system, there never was the Truth and Reconciliation efforts that were done say in South Africa or in other parts of the world when there have been great upheavals. And so it could be said that the country never has truly dealt with this, never confronted it fully.
And is part of the reason for that, getting back to the warmth of other suns, is part of the reason there never was that kind of truth and reconciliation because of this huge migration that took place?
I think that in an interesting way, the successes of some African Americans can in some ways be a diversion from the overarching impediments that have been in place for so long. I also think that because this happened on American soil, because this is something that forces us to look within the family of the United States, as opposed to looking at the awful things that may be happening in another country, on another continent. It's so much easier to look and see what's wrong in someone else's house rather than to see what's going on in one's own house.
The other part of the conversation you're starting to see take place is those people trying to move the conversation away from race and really about justice. And to the extent that it focuses on just that, it sort of negates or neglects the underlying issue of race.
Well, it negates the potential that a person could be judged or prejudged, which is where the word prejudice comes from, could be prejudged on the basis of what they look like, which is a frightening thing for anyone. I mean, and if any group could be prejudged and thus an individual could lose one's life on the basis of a prejudgment that some other person makes, then that means that we're all in danger, that anyone could prejudge someone else. And that does not make for civil society, and that's what's so frightening about all of this. And the idea of moving it away from the potential of it, of that being a factor, means that endangers all of us in ways that we, you know, can't see. I mean, there's even a discussion now that there's a bounty on Zimmerman's capture, uh-huh, which does not move it forward at all, because that only raises the stakes on what already is a dangerous and, as I've indicated, or as I believe, an unresolved series of issues that deserve resolution. I do think that looking at it from the point of justice, though, is a valid one, because clearly justice has not been served for many, over much of the history of this country. Justice had not been served in many precincts of this country, and so justice is as big a part of this as race itself.
Isabel Wilkerson, her National Book Critics Circle Award-winning book is The Warmth of Other Suns. Isabel, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.